Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Biography. I'm Mark Klobis, your host for the channel. Today, we'll be talking with William S. Belko about his biography of the 19th century politician and jurist Philip Pendleton Barber, entitled Philip Pendleton Barber in Jacksonian America, an Old Republican in King Andrew's Court. Steve, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could start us off, Steve, by telling us something about yourself.
Well, I'm no longer a scholar, I guess you could say. I used to be a professor, but now I'm the executive director of the Missouri Humanities Council, returned to my home state to do humanities programming statewide. So that has consumed my life for the last year and a half, and hopefully will consume it for the rest of it. So took away some time from writing books and articles and teaching to do this. So
interesting job. What was it that led you to write this book? Does Barber have any sort of connection with Missouri?
Very, very slight. The two of his sons actually died in St. Louis during a cholera epidemic prior to the Civil War, but that would be the extent of it. The real reason behind it, and it probably should have been my second instead of my fourth book, and I had started on it early when I was in grad school at Mississippi State University. My mentor and director of my graduate program, Charles Lowry, had written a book on James Barber, the elder brother, and back in 1984, and published also by the same press, University of Alabama Press. And I was kind of searching a little bit to alter my dissertation at that time. And he kind of put a little bug in my ear. He goes, well, if you ever want to change it radically, Philip Pendleton Barber definitely needs a biographer. And I always remember that. And as soon as I took over a position as an associate professor of history at the University of West Florida, I decided to embark on it. And several books and many articles later, I finally decided I'm going to do this one. And it, I guess there's kind of a little bit of an irony to that, because it could be my last one, I hate to say. So who knows? The current position is tough to keep on publishing. But that was it. It always had sparked an interest in me. And that is really Barber's era, that early Republican to the Jacksonian America, is truly the heart of what I love to study, what I love to teach. And so it's a perfect book for what I wanted to do.
Fascinating. What was it about Barber that interested you so much?
Well, you know, I just like his old Republicanism. They had always kind of, I guess, enticed me in some ways. In fact, my daughter is named after John Taylor of Caroline, so for some reason there's an affinity for that group. That always, the anti-federalism into the Jeffersonian Republicans and the old Republicanism. The other aspect of it was, is my key area is Jacksonian America. As a Jackson scholar, it always kind of intrigued me how many of these old Republicans somehow drifted into Jackson's ranks. It just, on the surface, appears that that should not happen. And I had even taught a course one time, a graduate seminar, on the old Republicans themselves, just, you know, on their history, their writings, things of that nature. And that's one of the things we explored as a class together, because I didn't have the answer to that. And it slowly, gradually came out in that course. And I thought, well, you know, I'm going to use Barber as kind of that maybe a microcosm of just one singular example of how somebody who was an old Republican could become a staunch Jacksonian. And so the subtitle of that book is far more important than its main title. And that's kind of an old Republican going into not only Andrew Jackson's administration, but literally his court as a Supreme Court justice, where he died. So there was always this intriguing question. And I got to explore the larger question by looking at a single individual, and one that I had already embarked on research and really enjoyed writing on anyway. So it was a great experience.
I'm surprised that it was that big of a question, given how in the book you make the evolution seem very natural.
Well, sometimes I guess that natural evolution is not obvious until you just look at it. And so I kind of wanted maybe a little more of a slap in the face. And I think one of the ones that I did try to approach in that book was the executive authority, the executive power. And old Republicans had long were jealous, in so many words. You know, they were suspect of executive authority from monarchy, as they attributed to Hamiltonian federalism. Many of them, not Barber's, but his next elder generation, had fought in the Revolution. And there's this classical Republican We don't like that executive authority, that executive power. And here, for the first time, is really the birth of the modern presidency, the imperial presidency. They didn't know it at this time. Andrew Jackson came in for a lot of people to save the republic, but he did it by enforcing executive authority. And so that was a little nuance for them. Here they are now supporting the executive power, whereas before that they had opposed it. And then there were some aristocratical elements to many of them. I remember John Randolph of Roanoke saying, "I'm not a Democrat, I'm an aristocrat." But you got to look further into that. This is also the era of, you know, the rise of the common man, majoritarian democracy, universal manhood suffrage. And that for old Republicans might have been suspect as well. And I think Barber fit that time because there was a states' rights element to that, and that kind of joined with him on that. But you would think that this planter would be an aristocrat, but he wasn't. And, you know, neither was Andrew Jackson, a planter, but never really an aristocrat. So he fit that mold.
I wonder if you could go back a bit and talk a bit about Barber's background, his family and his years growing up.
He comes from a very distinguished Virginia family and heritage. There's no doubt about that. His father had served in the American Revolution, a committee of safety, things of that nature, a vestryman in the parish there. So a planter, but a lawyer, but not a very successful one. Many Americans were in debt after the American Revolution, and his father was no different. But it was really the two surviving brothers, Philip and his elder brother James, who were very prominent, and not Virginia politics, but national politics. In fact, when Barber, during the War of 1812, the younger, Philip, went off to the Virginia House of Delegates, his brother's governor, was governor during the War of 1812. When he would go off to Congress, James Barber was in the United States Senate. In fact, they really had a parallel path. The great irony to it is that they diverged dramatically. James Barber going on to be a prominent national Republican, supporter of Clay and Adams, and in Adams' administration, Secretary of War, going on to eventually die as a Whig. And here is his brother, an old Republican, that will be in the House, serve as House of Representatives, and eventually go on to the United States Supreme Court. And they were, I mean, couldn't be further apart in their political views. But as I look at it in the book, the end was the same. They just had two different views to the same end of, you know, this. What does the American Republic mean? Mm-hmm. And so very prominent, the two of them.
And yet one of the interesting things in that you observe in your book is that for all of his very well-defined philosophy about government, Barber did not come from a academic position in the sense of having an extensive education or a grounding in the classics in the way that you might expect for someone who was who had Barber's subsequent reputation as a jurist.
Yes, correct. In fact, he was really to a great deal self-taught. Mm-hmm. His father did not have the income to put him, you know, in maybe a foreign school, send him up to New England or across the ocean to England. He never had that possibility, so a lot of it was self-taught. Both James and Philip had to encounter that. But he was socialized in a lot of that. I mean, that's all he heard on, you know, Sunday dinners. That's all he heard ever in family discussions or in local papers, was this old classical Republican, this old Republican mentality. His county was anti-federalist. So he came from that tradition. It's all he knew. And so it was very comfortable to him. And so I imagine when he did pick up a Bolingbrook or read, you know, Cato's letters, it was very familiar to him. Mm-hmm. And especially coming from Virginia and, you know, just being a young man, just getting his law degree with the Revolution of 1800, Jefferson's election, may have really inspired him and brought that out. But I think for the legal aspect, everyone who knew him considered him one outstanding lawyer and jurist, mm-hmm. A very, you know, clear mind, precision, logic. And so I think if it wasn't a little bit genetic, it was self-taught, discipline. And so it earned him a place in the Supreme Court eventually.
How important was his legal career to his start in politics?
Very, very important. Really, his generation, if you want to look at it as kind of the second generation of this American Republic, especially the planter class, their power is dissipating. And many of the Virginia statesmen are lawyers. They turn to the law. And law and politics were symbiotic. You really could not divide them. So if you were a lawyer, you're almost expected to be, especially if you're a planter on the side or a son of a planter, to enter politics. Just one followed the other. So it's very natural for a lot of Virginians, especially for Barber, to do so. So it's crucial, that connection between law and politics.
One of the things that I always think about in terms of that connection at the time were the circuits, because you have these lawyers who were not, who generally didn't have a fixed practice, but who traveled around quite a bit within a given geographical region. And one of the advantages that gave them is that they became familiar with a far greater swath of people socially, geographically, than if they had, say, been fixed to a particular plantation or a particular locale.
Right. Yes. And Barber did travel a lot when he was a lawyer, usually about in the 5-6 county area around Orange County. Eventually he did practice before the United States Supreme Court. But even when he was on as a federal judge for the Eastern District of Virginia and then on the Supreme Court, he got the district that covered Virginia. So he never really did travel if you look at it in a larger picture. In fact, a lot more justices had a lot more miles traveled mm-hmm. across the country. So maybe there was just a little bit of luck in that for him.
Mm-hmm. So when does he make that transition from a successful and lucrative legal career into politics?
Very early on. He began his law career in the year 1800 and entered the Virginia House of Delegates during the War of 1812 and then just served not even a full term there and then was elected in special election to go on to Congress in 1814. And so he served there except for one term, 1825 to 1827, all the way to 1830, when Jackson, promoted him to federal court and then eventually the Supreme Court. So it happened relatively quickly and about right at the same age as just about every other Virginian would have done it. So very early on, a very distinguished career at the time, too.
You point out in the book that it is also part of a broader generational transition that's taking place in politics, how he comes to Congress at the same time as this very remarkable cohort of younger, more younger politicians whose experiences aren't of the revolution, the draft and constitution, those very initial battles, but he's part of that new generation that's now coming to the fore.
Correct, and I call that the second generation. Mm-hmm. The first generation coming out of the revolution in the early parts. He was born in 1783, which was, the Treaty of Paris. So he's born in the same year as technically the United States is. So he is a second generation, as well as his brother. And so they had this heritage. They could feel it. It's very familiar to them. It was just around the corner, if you will. And then, with the War of 1812, really at the end of that, we start to see a new age, the second. The age of Jackson, 1815 to about the Mexican War. And you see this transition, from a republic to a democracy. And that's very difficult to follow because, well, just what does that mean? Mm-hmm. But he is part of that, that great transition from Jeffersonianism to Jacksonianism. And there's still debate today, well, was that a transition in republicanism? Mm-hmm. And I argue for Barber that is, that Jackson is this kind of classical republican saving the republic from consolidation, centralization, we have Clay in the American system succeeding, Hamiltonian federalism. So he sees Jackson and Jacksonianism as this kind of rebirth of the republic, and he wants to be part of that. So he is a pivotal figure in the second generation. Now, some of them, of course, were around during the Revolutionary period. He's probably one of the younger ones. Andrew Jackson himself, as a young man, young boy, if you want to put that way, served in the American Revolution. Mm-hmm. So maybe something familiar to turn to them. But they never were really the third generation that sent us off to, sectional discord, sectional disharmony, and eventually Civil War and Reconstruction. So they're right in that middle. a very important transition because it's also what we call, you know, that market revolution. We start to see the American economy changing in dramatic ways, and that will affect politics as well. And so he was crucial to that era.
Another area where I saw that in your book was when you talk about his attitude towards slavery. He was a slave owner, but he was not a enthusiastic proponent of the institution. He did not see it as an unbidden or indispensable national good.
Correct. He was not. If we wanted to divide the Southern slaveholder into two general schools, you have that kind of Virginia paternalistic perspective, and then you kind of eventually get the Deep South, the Calhounian imperial aspect of slavery and slavery expansion. And he was not part of that, and actually in several occasions showed some disdain for that. You know, he was not a supporter of Calhoun or a positive good slavery. And that really comes to the fore during the Missouri crisis, because he's a vocal participant in that. And so it's very difficult because today's eyes, we tend to look at it as slavery or pro-slavery, anti-slavery. And there was a much larger issue to that. And he was part of that, but he never defended it as a positive good. And he did struggle with it to some great extent, as well as a lot of other Virginians did at the time as well. So, and that school will eventually disappear by the time we get to the Civil War and you get the reactionists on both sides prevailing here. But no, he did struggle with it. It was not necessarily a positive good. It was a legal, juridical issue almost sometimes. And it was definitely a domestic question. It was something beyond the reach of Congress and could only be touched by the municipal, the positive law of states. And so that's pretty much where he extended it. Slave relations on the plantation were of that very paternalistic nature. So, in fact, I always recall that after he had died, his wife decided to sell most of the plantation and the slaves. And she refused to sell them unless they were sold as families and to be kept as families. Slavery is by itself a natural evil, but when you're struggling with it at that time, that's something that we can't imagine, I don't think. But it was never biblically sanctioned. It was not even really the natural way of the African. And in fact, when Africans were seized illegally, he was vociferous on freeing them, even on American soil, because he declared them to be free, natural men. So it's difficult to struggle with that. But slavery was really, when it comes right down to it, a legal issue.
And it wasn't quite the hot button political issue that it would become in that third generation that you mentioned.
Correct. Yes, and you know, maybe there's a little serendipitous to his career that he died while listening to the Amistad case, and all evidence is from what he had left behind and what other justices had left behind, especially Joseph Story, that he would have sided with the court in that decision and had no qualms about it. But really, the first, really, I guess, Supreme Court case that really kind of spurred the slavery issue on was, you know, Prigg v. Pennsylvania in 1842, but that was a year after he had passed. So I don't want to call it fortune that he didn't live longer than he did, but he escaped really the tawny court's, reputation of being pro-slavery. And we forget about that the first, you know, 4 to 5 years of Taney's term is very, very important for the development of the American economy, spurring on the market revolution. And he was part of that. And there was really only the economic issues of the day that he participated in, not just in Congress, but on the Supreme Court. So I
want to set that aside for a little bit later. I actually want to go back a bit and talk a bit about his time in Congress, because you talk about how he does represent the embodies the Jacksonian philosophy in his a lot of his arguments and his in its causes. But when he comes into Congress, it seems, and I like the way you depict this in the book, it seems in many respects that he is on the losing side. That the current of the times is against him in 1816,
right.
1818, 1820.
It is. We see the rise of judicial nationalism and economic nationalism, and they must go hand in hand to succeed. The Marshall Court would have never succeeded if it wasn't for the Madison administration supporting the judicial branch and joining with them, and somewhat under Monroe's administration as well. But yes, he was a vociferous opponent of the American system. He opposed the protective tariff. He was one of the first vocal members of the House to stand up and go against protectionism and on behalf of free trade. He was a vocal opponent of federally sponsored internal improvements, and that's where he really cut his teeth and made his reputation as this old Republican, because they're the ones really going after the American system in the 4 to 5 years after the end of the War of 1812. And he opposed the National Bank as well. And that really comes to the fore during Adams' administration, and he really kicks off the bank war. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Jackson was not a very big proponent of the American system. Barber was further along the spectrum against it as well, and especially the Marshall Court decisions that he sees upholding this economic nationalism. But during his lifetime, we do see a protective tariff, one of the largest, the tariff of 1824. We do see the General Survey, which is kind of a triumph for federally sponsored internal improvements. And, of course, we had a national bank, the second national bank, coming out of the War of 1812. So it's kind of a strike three for him by the time Adams comes to the presidency. And with the corrupt bargain, the death of John Taylor of Caroline, he just says he's had enough. I've fought the good fight. I'm returning to Virginia to continue it there. And it was just only one term out of Congress, and his district came back and said, we need you in those Jacksonian ranks. And even opponents, from Daniel Webster to Henry Clay, realized that if Barber comes back to Congress, most likely he will join that growing Jacksonian movement, and he did, and very vocally so, especially with really firing the first salvos of the bank war. And it was his bill to divorce the government from banking that got trounced. I think it was 127-9. But eventually, that will be the bank war that consumes much of Andrew Jackson's presidency. And he supported Jackson and Van Buren's financial policy and banking policy. So it was really those economic questions that really drove him. And mm-hmm. I will add that there was a constitutional aspect to that. He's one of the first to bring up the anti-constitutional aspect of a protective tariff of internal improvements. He was really probably one of the great last defenders of those principles of 98, the Virginia-Kentucky resolutions.
And we've been talking about him primarily from an ideological standpoint. One of the things that we haven't addressed yet is the fact that his standing was such that in the 1820s, he becomes Speaker of the House of Representatives, which really speaks to his influence and the regard in which his fellow congressmen held him.
Yeah, and there's two aspects of that one. One was the respect, the practical, pragmatic aspect, is this guy has the qualifications to be a Speaker of the House, the technical aspects, if you want to put it that way, and the support, a trust. Many sides could trust him. But I think a real key to that is it was really Van Buren and his bucktails that were really going to get rid of the previous Speaker of the House, Taylor, who was seen as, an opposition, an Adams man. And Van Buren and his supporters eventually turn to Philip Pendleton Barber. And that kind of really is another example of this growth of this Jacksonian organization, if you will. I mean, I think, Van Buren wanted the plain Republicans of the North and the farmers of the North and the planters of the South, uniting that New York, Virginia axis. And that was crucial. Since he's from New York and Barber's from Virginia, and that was the foundation for it. And so it shows that Barber is not this pro-slavery Southern fire eater that, Calhoun will become. He never was that. He was always behind Jackson, had supported Van Buren, opposed nullification. So it's crucial to show that transition from his old Republicanism to the Jacksonian ranks.
Well, he wasn't always behind Jackson, because you mentioned in 1824 he was a Crawford man, although a very tepid one.
Yeah, he never admitted it. In the election of 1824, he never came out on any side. It was only they assumed that he would be a Crawford man because Virginia, tended to be a Crawford state, if you will. And so he was just labeled by others, but he never publicly denied that label. Didn't do anything about it, and he never really campaigned on anything that would have been Crawford. For a lot of old Republicans, they were very suspicious of Crawford, which is a coincidence because he's running on those principles of 98, but they're not dumb. The old Republicans did not really support him until well into 1824. And one of the reasons why is, you know, he had actually come out for the Second Bank of the United States. He had he served in what they considered an economic nationalist Monroe administration. So he didn't have a perfect record on that, and so they just kind of held back on it. But it was the corrupt bargain, just how it was handled, that really just blew Barber. He said, that's about it. This is just not the government. I can't remember his exact quote, but no longer does my political creed exist. It is gone. And that is actually, he put that down on paper in a letter to his constituents. He missed his, when he left Congress after the election of 1824. He was done. He preferred, to be a lawyer. He defended to be a wanted to be a judge. Wanted to be close to his family. He's a strong family man. Hated being away from him. And for Scott, he needed a lot of attention. It's a major plantation. And so he just wants to return home. And one of the things he did say was, my political creed, my political maxim, no longer is prevalent. It's dead. And so, he was quite despair when he left Congress.
And that's why this period seems to loom so large, because this seems to be the key point in that transition from old Republicanism to Jacksonianism. It's a stage in that process.
It is. There is a component of that. And it may be his leaving Congress from about 1825 to 1827, maybe gave him that outsider perspective, because Jackson was considered in 1824 the real non-Washington D.C. the outsider, and so maybe he kind of got a little bit of that in himself. And when he did return to Congress midterm, they even considered him for Speaker of House. Coincidence there is that they selected another Virginian, Andrew Stevenson, instead of Barber. There you can see Van Buren really building this axis between Albany and Richmond, and Barber is key to that, and especially with his bank war policies. By this time, the internal improvements and the protective tariff are still major issues. We know the tariff of 1828, the tariff of abominations, as some would call it. There's a reason why he was not as vociferous against that. He did stand up once and say, pretty much you've all heard me back the past 20 years or so, rail against it. You know where my policies are. I don't have anything to add. But he's also noticing that there's really a campaign ploy to get Jackson elected, to help secure his election, and he is part of that. And in fact, he was on the committee that, and he was really motioning, hey, we've counted the electoral votes, let's tell the world. He was part of that committee. He wanted to present it to the Senate and then, let Jackson know that, hey, you're president. He's very happy for that, and it expressed throughout his letters and his family letters as well.
And how did Jackson recognize that support that Barber gave him?
Jackson, even from that bank war, there was a few comments that he had made, very positive about what Barber was doing. And Barber was actually considered one of the early potential attorney generals. A lot of people, including Jackson, were looking to him to serve in his cabinet. And it looks like the choice for attorney general probably should not have been made. There's other reasons why Jackson and some of his supporters went that route. People during the day and even scholars later probably said it had been a better choice to take a second Barber. But after the 1831 cabinet reorganization, that whole brouhaha, he again turned to Barber. Would you be in my cabinet? And again, Barber declined, not in opposition, but he just didn't want that position. And Jackson, elevated him to a federal court, put him on the ticket, kind of, if you want to put it that way, with Taney, which is kind of a coincidence because Taney became attorney general. and Barber declined. And eventually they thought actually that Barber might be in the running for Chief Justice if Marshall dies or something. That he was at the top of the list on the opponents. The opposition thought Jackson's probably going to appoint him. So eventually he did to the Supreme Court, kind of put him and Taney together, but reversed them, Taney for Chief Justice and Barber for Associate Justice. So he was always there, looming somewhere in the background in the Jackson administration. And so the only time that they had maybe a potential falling out, and Barber eventually nixed it, was in the election of 1832, and it was not the presidential election. Everybody pretty much knew it's Jackson and Clay and over the bank, but the vice presidential selection. Jackson handpicked his right-hand man, Van Buren, And there was a movement not to put Van Buren on there through certain southern and western circles. And so the West tended to turn to another candidate, and many in the South turned to Barber. Mm-hmm. And it was very, very controversial. It went on and on through the campaign season. It wasn't until October that Barber finally publicly said, I am not a candidate for the office of vice president. And then he came out and supported Van Buren and opposed some of the things Calhoun was doing. In fact, it was the first time that he'd come out vocally against nullification. Mm-hmm. He was always Jackson had always turned to him for a variety of reasons and positions and posts as well. So there was a reward to be coming.
Mm-hmm. And yet you stress in the book that he really was not drawn to those executive positions that he had long sought or long desired a position on the bench.
Correct. Yes, it was always the bench and bar. Even when he was in Congress, there was a lot of distaste to it when he was there. He'd like to return to his family, and he'd always try to get his family to come up and visit him there. He was not very, he didn't really like to go out in the circuits, as in the politics and society of Washington, D.C. He preferred to take a walk, maybe with his daughter who would come and visit, or read, things of that nature. So the federal government really was never that great of a lure to him, and that speaks a lot to that kind of old republicanism. Because they always kind of had this anti-government, anti-centralized aspect to this, and he preferred a state. He preferred to be a lawyer, but he did love the bench more than anything. And eventually, he'll die on the bench, mm-hmm. on the highest court. And he was extremely excited. His family was extremely excited when they were catching wind that he was on the top of the list with Taney to be nominated. You can see there's a difference between his comments about, oh, I got to go back to Congress for another term, versus, holy cow, this is, this is one of the greatest things ever for my life. So, yes, he did prefer, I guess, the juridical side, if you want to put it, the judicial side. And so it was nothing against Andrew Jackson. He just did not have any desire to serve in a cabinet in that capacity.
Now, when Jackson names him to the Supreme Court and he is confirmed by the Senate, what is the state of the Supreme Court at that time? Whose views are in the ascendancy, and where does Barber fit in that jurisprudential spectrum?
Barber goes right with the Jacksonian court. It is Jacksonian through and through, especially when Taney takes over. It had gradually worked its way that way with Marshall's death and a few others before that, and some of Jackson appointments trickling in. But it's really Taney and Barber who seal that. And it's the great 1837 term, where the major questions they are economic. It's almost as if... in fact, I think Barber made a reference for it that, now we had the kind of the revolution of 1828, and now we've got the Supreme Court's revolution coming in to secure the Jacksonian philosophy, if you will, of government and economy. And it was those three great Supreme Court cases of that 1837 term that really spur on this market revolution. And it kind of shows that the Marshall Court had its day. It had its purpose. And there is some continuity from the Marshall Court and the Taney, but there is some dramatic change, too, that was needed to promote the economy. And they succeeded at that. And he was one. He wrote the opinion for one of those three terms. And so, one of those three great cases, New York v. Milne, state police powers doctrine. And so he really fit that promotion of this kind of age, the market revolution, if you will. And that was it, because he's only going to live 3.5 more years. And so really it was only the financial aspects of this, the economic, which fits everything. That's what he had. That was his main slogan and maxim and partisanship during his congressional career, was to overthrow economic nationalism and the judicial nationalism that supported it. Protective tariff and federally sponsored internal improvements, the bank, national bank, and all that. So it's kind of a fitting in for him.
Could you explain a bit more about the Milne case and how that fits? Because you, in your book, you say it's the most important opinion that he writes during his time on the Supreme Court.
Correct. It is. There's no doubt about it. And the state police powers doctrine will go on, no doubt, through the 19th century and to a certain extent the early 20th century, good and bad. The opinion has been used for various purposes to stop progress and reform, if you want to put it that way. But during this period, it really fit with the other Supreme Court cases that are coming out of the Taney Court that leaves the states and the people of the states, especially the state legislatures, who more directly represent the people than Congress, I don't want to say the right, but they have the power, they have the authority to direct their own social and economic affairs, because each state, each region of the nation is completely different. And eventually that will trickle up and build this great national economy, which it does. They do succeed at that. And as for New York v. Milne, there is some controversy by current scholars with the slavery issue. I never found that in there, just because not only is it not in there in his opinion, but never showed anywhere when he's in Congress or anywhere else. But basically he gave the commerce powers of the government weren't in question. It was, you know, it was, I guess you would put it, state authority. It was the right of the state to regulate its economy, its society, to promote its own health, welfare, morals, its own safety. And that is strewn all throughout the Charles River Bridge case that Taney had done in that same term. And that is that, the end justifies the mean, and the end is the public welfare, not private interests. And what is ever good for the general welfare, what is good for the advancement of the general community, that's it. That's what we are going to decide on. It's not so much A versus B and who legally is right, A versus B, but there's a higher C, if you will. And it's society, it's the economy, it's progress. It's the advance of the economy, the advance of the interest of the people. And that's another very Jacksonian. Jackson's famous quote, you know, the will of the majority shall prevail, and that fits with it. He stood with New York on that.
Yeah, because the context of the case was that you have New York trying to, they have a law that had been in place for about a decade and a half where they were trying to regulate the entry of people into their state.
Correct. Yes.
Go ahead.
Basically, what they did is they said anybody who, a ship coming in the port of New York would have to post security, if you will. I can't remember the amount of it, what it was, but to make sure that any passengers that exit that ship don't become a ward of society, whether they might be paupers or mentally insane or anything. You know, it's not going to be on the public charge of New York to take care of this. And you had to submit a list of your passengers and all this. And Milne refused to do it because he said he violated pretty much interstate commerce. If I don't have to do this in Baltimore, well, I don't have to do it in New York. And Barber will go farther. He'll say this has nothing to do with interstate commerce. This has to do with the health, the welfare of the people of New York. It is, their determination. Their state legislature followed the will of the majority of the people. And the greater good of the community believes and deems this law as necessary. And he went with that.
Hence your formulation.
Taney would do.
Hence the way you describe it as an action of the state police power.
Correct. Yes. And that really kind of goes back to his political philosophy. He always believed that in those principles of 98, the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions. That was really his Bible. And part of that is, not only decentralization, a strict construction of the Constitution, the reserve powers are always more important than the delegated powers. The reserve powers must be jealous of the advance of the delegated powers. So part of that was the compact theory of the Union, that states never relinquished their sovereignty. They were sovereign beings. They'd only granted certain powers to a central government, and thus farther it shall not go. It's reserved to the people and the people of the states, and only they know what's best for their own good. Another reason why he used that argument against the protective tariff. So it's very pervasive throughout his thought, not only in Congress, but also when he gets to the Supreme Court. So the state police powers doctrine is just a continuation of his political beliefs and political practices while he was in Congress.
It seems, after reading your book, that he would be much better remembered today had he continued on the bench, and yet he only had this short 5-6 year period. What brought about his early death?
You know, I actually think he's lucky he died. I always hate to say that; it sounds so bad. And the reason for that was, I was really actually moved when I read letters from his children and his wife. It's a very, death is far more prevalent back then than it is today. But wow, you could tell that a father and a husband, a dad and a husband, had passed, and people are stunned and hurt for that. But you know, I think he would have been tarnished, as all of those very elderly second-generation Americans were, because of the Civil War. And that, I'm going to, throw in on the guilt that a lot of my colleagues, modern scholars, who I think look at it in 21st, late 20th century views. And I think Taney is one of the greatest Supreme Court justices, not for what he did in the 1840s and 50s and into the Civil War, but basically what he did for the Jacksonian cause, an 1837 term and through the early 1840s. And the same thing, John Tyler, who is a very close, not a staunch old Republican, but you can maybe barely put him in there. But he and Barber were really early on in the 1820s, opposed to that protective system, against internal improvements, the bank war. They always fought together on that. Tyler pushed for peace as best he could. But you see them now as, I think they're tarnished. Taney's reputation is tarnished because of the onset of Civil War, and I believe in Tyler and a lot of those others who are of Southern nature, Virginians especially, may be tarnished because of that. And I think he would have been.
So Taney and Taylor serve as models of Tyler serve as models of what might have happened to Barber's reputation.
Yeah, I can't see it going any other way, and it goes along with a lot of, if you want to call them, these Jacksonian Democrats, many of them who fought secession to the very end and only joined their states when, secession had happened. He probably might have gone that far. I think he would have been with Tyler to promote peace. He had always promoted sectional harmony and union, just as Jackson did. Constantly. In fact, in all of his speeches in Congress, against some of these policies that he opposed, he said these are fomenting sectional animosity. Disharmony, has potential for cutting the cords of union, whether it's regionalistic or however. And so he promoted, we need to have a larger, promotion of national harmony, just as Jackson would. He disdained disunion, and so did Barber, vocally, but you don't know how you act when you're coming down to that very moment of 1861 or any of those, that time period. Mm-hmm. And so I think he would have fallen right in with all of those who were, tarnished because of that era. Fortunately, he died at the right time,
yeah.
Right at the Amistad case, and left a legacy that was very, I guess, consistent with what he believed prior to his death.
Defined by what happened in the decades preceding versus the decades following.
For Barber, anyway, in that slavery issue, the Amistad, he had actually in Congress on twice, there was the same issue, and one was the Antelope, and I don't recall what the other one was, where he had supported the freeing of Africans detained or captured illegally, not to be returned even to, Spanish, possession, because the federal government can't enslave. He was very vocal on that. And that's kind of the Amistad decision that came out was really exactly in line on several major occasions that he had spoken in Congress prior, back in, I think one was 1828, and the other one prior to that, dealing with the same issue that came before Congress. And so it was very consistent, and I do put in the book those arguments he makes, and they're almost the same thing. And so we don't know exactly what he was saying about the Amistad case, but we do know from Story and the other justices that he ardently agreed with them.
Mm-hmm.
They had discussed the issue the night of his death, and they were all very unanimous and very happy. They're all going to bed, they said, just probably stayed up too late because they were all having a good time, enjoying the conversation and all. And so, I just hate to see what happens in 1842 with Prigg v. Pennsylvania and the demise of State Comity and breaking down over the fugitive slave issue, how he would have got torn into that issue. So maybe a very, very good time to pass away, I hate to say that.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time, but before we go, Steve, I was wondering if you could tell us if you have any projects in mind for the future.
I do. I got, as executive director of the Humanities Council, we have two major ones. One is our state's Native American heritage, mainly with the Osage, but the other 8 to 9 tribes that lived here, restoring their culture, their language, back here in our state where they're from. We just had some legislation passed in the state of Missouri recognizing Missouri's German heritage and created a corridor. And German heritage is our state's most prevalent, by far, ethnicity, as well as for the rest of the United States. And we're kind of taking the lead, and we wrote the legislation, and we're going to study German culture from our state's founding, 1820s, the first wave, you know, through World War One, World War Two, and show kind of the history and transition of that to what it is today. But as for pure scholarly, I might just stick to a big event that's coming up here in my state starting in 2018 and going all the way to 2021, and that's our bicentennial. And if any state entered the Union in the brouhaha way, it is ours. So we do plan, in fact, the State Historical Society of Missouri and the Missouri Humanities Council have been charged with the celebration, the commemoration of this, from creating a license plate dedicated to it, to scholarly programs, things of that nature, publications. And so I think I'm going to turn back to the Jacksonian era once again, but have more of a focus on my state of Missouri and its entrance into the Union. So I might play a little bit of public programming with some little private scholarship. So that's where it stands for now.
That sounds like a great, you know, opportunity that's coming up for you.
It is, yes. I think, and the whole nation's going to turn its eyes once again to Missouri. So hopefully we can make it a little more clean than it was last time. So who knows?
Well, Steve Belko, thank you very much for taking some time out of your busy schedule to speak with us. I hope you have a wonderful day.
You too. Thank you. I appreciate the time.